Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder, how can a loving God just sit back while Southern Californians lose their homes in a horrible fire? Actually, my friend, our culture has advanced beyond people associating national disasters and natural disasters with God. Oh, yes, that still happens, of course. But what's latest, what's fashionable, what's cool and sophisticated and politically correct is to associate natural disasters with human beings. In this vein, a few days ago for Facebook, I was going to write one of my typical half-satire, half-serious posts, which would have wondered out loud how long it would take for people to blame the California fires on President Donald Trump. Now, I got distracted with a lot of work and never got around to writing the post. Now, alas, my predictive powers will go forever void of their due accolades, because in the tradition of truth being stranger than fiction, in the tradition of not being able to make up satirical news any stupider than real news, I was beaten to the punch. Comedian Chelsea Handler tweeted, "Just evacuated my house. It's like Donald Trump is setting the world on fire, literally and figuratively. Stay safe, everyone. Dark times." Okay, now I am very sorry that Chelsea Handler or anyone had to lose their home. I'm also sorry she felt the need to interpret the tragedy. Now, to be fair, I was also expecting some fellow Christians, who seldom disappoint in the art of jumping to conclusions, to start making comments about how God is judging California for its recent rulings coming out of Sacramento. This, too, happened on schedule. Well, I certainly agree that the politicians in our capital are certifiable, and while the Bible does talk about cities and nations being judged by God for far less than what California has done, we do not know why God allows a specific present-day natural catastrophe unless he sends an actual prophet. An actual prophet, incidentally, is one who truly hears God's voice, not somebody who decides that since he feels strong and passionate about something, it must mean God is leading him. Meanwhile, as liberals talk about the stupidity and heartlessness of Christians and conservatives who ponder the possibility of God judging California, I would remind everybody to check their memories. Now, let's all check our memories. You don't even have to pull up a file from too long ago. How many self-righteous, sanctimonious comments did we hear from the left about God judging Texas with floods and hurricanes because they were too far to the right? Ironically, the more liberal oasis of Texas, otherwise known as Houston, was hit hardest during that hurricane. I point that out not to comment on why Houston was hit, but instead as an example of how quickly people activate their mouths before activating their brains, all to say, sometimes floods and fires just happen. Sometimes people are suffering enough and don't need ignorant loudmouths to pour salt in their wounds perhaps our best response to Californians, Texans, or anyone would be to offer our help and compassion, even directing it toward those who represent another side of the political religious spectrum. Maybe we don't need to assume God causes natural disasters any more than we need to assume Trump caused them by pulling out of the climate accord. Let us admit once in a while that we do not always know nearly as much as we think we know. Meanwhile, not knowing everything doesn't mean we can never know anything. Related to this discussion, there is still one fact we can be sure of, and another possibility we can at least be reasonably sure of. First, the certainty. The real God really will judge the world someday prior to the return of Jesus Christ. We do not know when this will happen. It may be in our generation. It may be 100 years from now. It may be 3,000 years from now, but it will happen. That is definite. Not quite as definite, but within the realm of high odds, when this worldwide cataclysm preceding Christ's return does come, people will probably attribute it to global warming. And now let me introduce a man who I do attribute to God. I do not attribute him to global warming. Say hello once again to Jim Barrier.
Hey, Bob, what a great intro. And I agree with you completely on that take about the fires, as well as the floods we had here in the state of Texas. Now, you may not be aware, but we had a huge climate catastrophe here in San Antonio. Thursday night, it snowed.
What are you going to do about that global warming? It just keeps snowing and snowing.
We're doing a study. We're doing a study to determine whether or not it was caused by fossil fuel emissions or bovine flatulence.
Well, you let me know how that study turns out. I'll be waiting with bated breath.
I'm sure you will. It was a crazy thing. And one of my California friends said, does it snow a lot in San Antonio? I said, it snows about as often as the Chargers make the Super Bowl. So there's my take on the global climate changes. Now, I have to say this. Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. The president, by example, has given me the freedom once again to say Merry Christmas without being embarrassed or ashamed or afraid of, you know, being pressured by political correctness. Merry Christmas, everybody. And I love the fact that the White House once again is celebrating one of the great holidays and is unashamed about that. So
I know. Isn't it amazing how in the past it's, well, we are celebrating something around this time of the year, but keep it under your hat what we're really going to call it. All right, Jim, we'll be right back.
Okay.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net. When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to 1170 The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel, welcoming once again our rotating co-host, Jim Barrier.
Hey, Bob. Now, we departed. I made a comment about the president, and like him or not, and yeah, I know his personality is just a little bit too much for some people, but I've really been pleasantly surprised by some of the things he's doing, and we mentioned the Christmas and embracing that. I need to ask you this, because I know you have written a lot and studied a lot in your background, would be more qualified to address this thing. Every show you open with the theme from the movie Exodus, based on the book by Leon Uris, is that correct?
And the movie that they made based on it, yes. Academy Award piece of music.
Yeah.
Yes.
Great music.
By Ernest Gold, wonderful music.
Great stuff. I want to know what you think about the president moving, or at least wanting to move, the embassy to Jerusalem and the significance of that.
Yeah. Well, let me start with the response of Hamas. Hamas immediately announced, when they heard that, a day of rage. A day of rage over President Trump agreeing that Israel, like other countries, is entitled to declare its own capital. So I'm listening to this from Hamas, and I'm thinking, a day of rage. Wow, never seen that from Hamas before.
It's a peaceful religion.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, well, what might be really refreshing is to see Hamas pick a special day to not rage for a change. To now, they've helped the so-called peace process like a symphony helps a headache. So that's where I would begin with Hamas. I mean, it's just insane. And our last three presidents have promised that they would switch our embassy from Tel Aviv, where everybody has it, to Jerusalem. But they didn't go through with it because our spineless presidential candidates, while they're running, they're interested in pleasing the voters, and not just the voters, but the lobbyists and the pressure groups. But then once they come into office, they're surrounded by these nutcase cabinet members who say, well, you can't say this or you'll affect that person. And you can't do that or you'll offend this. And so the idea is, if we were to recognize Jerusalem, that would obstruct the peace process. What peace process?
Yeah, right.
When people don't understand, and I know we've talked about this before, you've come on our show. We recently, over the summer, did a 6-part series about Israel.
Right.
I've written a book about Israel, so I know this is a little bit of review. But when the Palestinians talk about Israel's occupation, everybody thinks they're talking about the West Bank and the Golan Heights and place. They're talking about all of Israel, ladies and gentlemen. The Palestinians do not recognize Israel's right to exist, period. And when Israel did come into fruition legally through the United Nations, the Arabs who lived in the land, who at that time were calling themselves Arabs, not Palestinians, the Arabs who lived there were offered their own separate state. They turned it down. And many of them fled Israel to get out of the way of Egypt and Syria and other armies that said, we're coming through. We're going to annihilate Israel, but the war will be over in 5 minutes. Just get out of the way, and then you can move back in your homes. It didn't happen that way. Meanwhile, there were a lot of Arabs who were invited by the Israelis to stay, and they stayed, and they became Israeli citizens. Not every Israeli citizen is a Jew. The Arabs who became citizens of Israel have more rights in Israel than any Arab in any Arab or any Muslim in any Muslim country. And this is something you never hear about in the news. So there is not going to be any two-state solution. And by the way, that's one of my criticisms with Trump. Like you, Jim, I think both of us kind of held our nose and picked him as the lesser of two evils. I think likewise, both of us have been very pleasantly surprised since he's been in office.
Yeah.
I continue to have problems with him. But what's interesting is the problems I'm having with him are not the problems that most other people are. When people call him a racist, that's nonsense. The very liberals who say that have never felt that way about him. They palled around with him for years when he was a liberal Democrat. It was only when he switched and became a Republican and started running for president that all of a sudden he was a racist and he's another Hitler. Interesting that Hillary would invite somebody who she thinks is a Hitler to the wedding of her daughter Chelsea. So it's total hypocrisy. Yeah. So yeah. He has problems, but what he's constantly accused of are not the problems. One of the problems he does have, though, is he thinks he can make a deal with anybody. And if he thinks he's going to make a deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians, he's in for a rude awakening. Now, I'll say this. The guy's a quick study. He learns very fast. And he may be learning already. You know, what does Trump do when he gets pushed? We know that it's the New Yorker in him that he pushes back right away.
Back.
When Palestinians are out burning pictures of him because of this Jerusalem thing, they're not really endearing him to go in there and make this deal, but he still thinks he's going to make this stellar deal. And he thinks, well, my son-in-law's Jewish, so obviously he'll make a good deal. He doesn't understand Israel. He doesn't understand that liberal Jews in Israel are very anti-Israel and very pro-Palestinian. And I don't really know his son personally, but I know the fact that his son is Jewish and wants to make a deal, that really doesn't mean jack. They can make a deal on paper. It might look good. It might read good. They might even sign it. But you know what's going to happen peace-wise? Nothing.
Yeah.
Whenever Israel's given back land, there have been attacks the next day. When they finally gave back the Gaza Strip, they started firing missiles into Israel the very next day. So there is not going to be any peace. And I'm not one of those Christians saying, because I believe in the second coming, I know there won't be any peace till Jesus comes. That may be true in its own right, but I'm talking about the kind of stuff that an atheist who just reads the news and just studies what went on in the 20th and early 21st centuries, just based on that, they ought to know that there is not going to be any peace over there. They do not recognize Israel's right to exist, period. So it's not going to happen. So when they say, "Oh, making Jerusalem the capital, that's thwarting the peace process," really, what peace process?
Yeah, I haven't seen anything on that side.
Well, that's what you get for asking me to take up a whole segment, Jim.
But there's more to do
when we get back. We'll be right back. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480539, W&S Electric.
The verdict is in on Bob Siegel's novel, The Dangerous Christmas Ornament. Readers love it, and they say as much in their customer reviews. Reviews such as this one. Like the Chronicles of Narnia in the last century, the story is fun and mysterious, appropriate for adults as well as kids, and should become a classic. I won't even give any spoilers, but I will say that I couldn't put it down.
It makes a point without being preachy. There are twists and turns and a great ending. Like the title object, the story challenges your thinking without leaving you in despair. This book would make an excellent Christmas gift for yourself or others, and it can be enjoyed at any time of the year. The Dangerous Christmas Ornament, available on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Here with Jim Barrier, we've been talking about Israel, and a couple of days ago, Jim, I had sent a message to my brother over Facebook, my brother Paul Siegel, who lives in Israel and actually lives in the West Bank, the quote-unquote occupied territory, and I asked him if he was safe, and this just came in over Facebook right while we were talking. He said, Bob, well, there have been lots of news reports about demonstrations in terms of casualties. There's no real big difference between this or any other week. A lot of what you're reading is just fake news to make a big splash in the press to make it look like Trump lit the world on fire. But he's not trying to say by that that things have been peaceful. He's just saying it's no less peaceful than normal.
Yeah, yeah, it's never been peaceful there in my lifetime. Now, just a couple of addendums to the subject of who occupies, who owns, and who has a right. Am I correct in saying Muhammad never went to Jerusalem?
That is correct. There's some legend about a quote-unquote spiritual journey that he took, and supposedly from the mount of where the temple is now, where the temple used to be, where the Dome of the Rock is now, they claim that he went from there and took a trip to heaven. That's all legend, but Arabs have no claim to that land until the time of Muslim expansion. It is true that whereas in Muhammad's lifetime, he never went there. Muhammad, when he recited the command, really did command jihad, really did command Muslims to conquer the entire world for Allah. And they started it in his lifetime. That's how he conquered Arabia. That's how he took the Arabian Peninsula. However, he passed away before the expansion continued to other places, and it eventually grew to Europe, to Africa, and to the Holy Land. So for a while, you had a lot of Arab Muslims in the Holy Land, and then with the Catholic Church and the Crusades, it changed landlords back and forth.
Back and forth.
But there had always been a remnant of Jews who lived there. Now, the Jews were there originally, conquered by the Romans, living under the Romans at the time of Christ. A few decades after Christ's death and resurrection, Prince Titus and the Roman Legion destroyed the temple and a great deal of Jerusalem. Early in the second century, under the reign of Emperor Hadrian, they destroyed the rest of the city. At that time, many of the Jews were either slaughtered, taken into captivity and made slaves, or scattered around the world because they fled, and a handful remained. But at this time, this is what's key, Emperor Hadrian renamed the land and called it Syria Palestinia. Palestinia was a Latinized name of Philistine, an ancient enemy of the Jews that we read about in the Old Testament. And it was pretty public that they had been the ancient enemy of the Jews. The Philistines did not exist anymore, but it was known that that was their old ancient enemy. So just to rub the Jews' noses in it and rub their faces in it, he renamed that land Palestine, and that became its unofficial nickname for many years. So when you even go into the history of that name, it's interesting. But now the rewritten history is, there's this indigenous group of people called the Palestinians who lived there since ancient times. And the Jews have no historical ancient claim to the land. They just came from Europe and came over there in the 20th century and kicked them. It's all other nonsense. And yet that's just exactly what's being taught in many, many places today.
By the way, Hadrian flunked geography. And I'll tell you why. He started heading north, got up into the British Islands. They didn't call it that then, but and he got up into the north part there, and there were these guys that wore skirts that ran around like guerrilla warfare, and the Roman soldiers could not defeat. the Highlanders. So he built the wall, which is now called Hadrian's Wall.
Oh, yeah, Hadrian's Wall, yeah.
And said, the Roman Empire ends here, and yet Rome was supposed to be the conqueror of the world. And so he said, well, the world essentially ends here. And so he was not really good at that whole geography, boundaries, and definitions and everything.
Well, you know, Jim, Hadrian never got a chance to watch Braveheart, but it's not his fault, because in Hadrian's day, they just had the reel-to-reel. They didn't have DVDs and Blu-ray yet.
Exactly.
So we got to cut him a little bit of a break.
They probably had 8-track music, too. Now, one more thing, and we're completely departing from the script tonight, but... Is the name Jerusalem in the Quran? I know you've studied the Quran much more than I have.
The Quran talks a lot about certain Old Testament stories. I do not recall at the moment whether the word Jerusalem is in the Quran. I would have to check that. It's possible, because they do refer to the Bible, meaning Old and New Testament, as being the Word of God. But I don't, and I've read the Quran, I don't recall at the moment seeing the actual word Jerusalem, but that one I'd have to double check on.
I think you will not. It was kind of a trick question. I don't believe that the word or name Jerusalem occurs in the Quran anywhere.
That was the way I was kind of recalling it, but I wasn't absolutely sure. But if you've just recently checked that on a
I researched that.
Very good, so, very good. So
Muhammad really never went there physically.
No, that we know.
The city is never mentioned in their holy scriptures, and yet they're fighting over the right to the city. I liken it to a couple who's had a bitter divorce, and they're both saying, I want the kids, not because they want the kids, but because they don't want the other side to have the kids.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So now we've spent half the show, but it's just fun. I enjoy this. Let me just tell you, this is just in. I know you are a film buff, and in a few days there's a new movie coming out, the next episode of Star Wars called The Last Jedi. And I have this inside information that I want to share with you.
Okay.
In the new movie, they introduce a new ship, and the name of the ship is the Millennial Falcon.
Okay.
And I thought, the Millennial Falcon...
No, wait a minute. I thought that was Han Solo's ship's name.
No, that was Millennium.
Millennium. Oh, so now it'll be Millennial. You're right. The Millennium Falcon.
And here's what goes on. On the Millennial Falcon, there is no pilot, because no one person should be more important than everyone else. The passengers are all entitled to whatever they want, as long as it doesn't offend other passengers. The ship still has the smuggling compartments, because everyone needs a safe place. The ship has no weapons and doesn't take sides in the conflict between so-called good and evil. Passengers are non-judgmental, and they do not tolerate intolerance. They may believe in the dark side and the light side at the same time, which is likely to leave them with a checkered past. The one tradition they still hold on to in the Millennial Falcon is trust your feelings. So you have that inside information. I bet you didn't know that.
Now, that was creative. Did you make that up, or did you read that somewhere?
I did. I made it up today, in fact.
Well, first of all, let me say two things. First of all, you should be employed by Mad Magazine. They'd probably be happy to have you.
But
what's scary is, I have the feeling that if George Lucas was related still to his own franchise, the movie might actually end up looking a little bit like that.
Well, I have concerns that actually some of this is going to be is going to come out of the thing. I haven't seen the film, and they have they've made all of the people who saw the previews swear to not give spoilers. But I think we're going to find a lot of that type of sentiment.
Some political Well, it already started with Lucas remaking his movies. There's that scene where. What's the name? Yeah. Greedo? I think Greedo was the name.
Yeah.
And Han Solo shot him from across the table, but they changed it so that Greedo shot first.
Han shot first. I'm telling you, folks,
in the original
Han
one,
shot first.
But in the remake, Lucas. And that's why I think once a movie's made, it should remain as a time capsule. I don't like, you know, Lucas claims he's going in to upgrade the effects, and then he starts changing everybody's favorite line and messing with everything. If he really wanted to go back in and get rid of the Ewoks and give us something more interesting for the Return of the Jedi, I could maybe get on board for that. But unfortunately, he messes with some of the good scenes.
Yeah, and there's too much marketing with those toys. They're going to do that on this one, too. They have a little creature that is a little plush toy, and they're going to make millions off of that. But so I just wanted to give you my warning
That was very clever. You should put that up on your Facebook post or somewhere. That was very clever.
I did.
All right. Go to Jim Barrier's Facebook post and try to friend him. Maybe he'll let you read that thing.
Okay. How are we doing here? Are we getting close to...
We're about halfway through the show, so we got about half a show for you to do what you originally wanted to do.
Well, but I have another thing. I've got so much stuff tonight. I just finished a book. It's actually a small book. It's a one-act play, and I want to read a couple of lines from this book because I read this book, and I was challenged and convicted by this book. And here's a couple of lines. This is some conversations going on between some preachers. A ministry based on the good news of repentance and forgiveness has brought you the kind of glory which now camouflages private imperfection. People who place men like you on pedestals, mistaking powerful personality for powerful spirituality, leaving you above reproach. You might recognize those words. Those are from The Melting Candle, a one-act play by Bob Siegel. I just did a plug for you, man.
Yeah, I'm sitting here listening going, boy, that sounds like something I wrote once.
You know what? Powerful. Powerful.
Oh, well, I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah.
Well, when we first met, you and Gary were, I came on as a guest on your show in Texas called Resistance Radio, and I know that one of your themes was to be kind of an internal conscience of the church.
Yeah.
So I thought you would appreciate that because it puts such a spotlight on very typical pastors, and we don't always hold our pastors accountable on what drives and motivates them.
No, and we should, and I include myself in that, and the elders in my church have the responsibility to call me out if they see any kind of moral issues that are questionable. They're to call me out on that. If I'm teaching heresy or false doctrine, they're to call me out on that. And I will receive correction if those types of things happen. Now, style, philosophy of ministry, personality things, those are things that just, vary from one pastor to the next. But this book, folks, I'm doing a free commercial here for The Melting Candle, and I've read...
And I didn't even know he was going to do this, ladies and gentlemen.
No, I know you didn't. That's why I kind of sucker-punched you there. But I just want to say it's one of the shortest pieces you've done, but one of the most powerful. So kudos to you. Great job on that. Very challenging. I would imagine there would be some ministers or pastors who would read this and have a problem with it, which is just up my alley.
Well, I do a lot of one-man shows where I'll take one of these scripts, and I performed that first back in the year 1985 at a campus ministry meeting where there were a lot of peers. There were about 30, 40 full-time pastoral campus ministers listening, and they were devastated by it in a positive way, though. I mean, they came and said it made me think. We'll be right back. This is Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Looking for a place where you can be yourself without having to act more spiritual than you really are? Looking for a church where you can have the dynamics of a large worship service, but the intimacy of a small group? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego by 94 in Hamasha? I know you'll enjoy the preaching of nationally famous speaker, Pastor Jim Garlow. You can also get to know people through a midweek small group. And for those who want to dig deeper into the Bible, a whole series of classes are offered on Sunday mornings. I teach one of them myself, Forbidden Table Talk, same name as my column, a time to bring up any Bible-related question at all. I would love to see you there. Now, I'm not saying Skyline doesn't have other good classes that you could take as an alternative to mine. I'm just saying don't take any of those. Take Forbidden Table Talk. Actually, you'll enjoy any experience you choose at Skyline Church. Skyline Church, Sunday morning services at 8:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m. The Bob Siegel Show. I wanted to mention that you are listening to our last live show of the year. We will be on for the rest of December, of course, but we will be going into repeat broadcasts. I like to take a lot of time off during Christmas time. And unbeknownst to my friend Jim Barrier, the show that I'm repeating next week is the one that he did a year ago at this time last year, where we had our Christmas bumper music, and it was a fun show because Nick kept playing popular Christmas songs on the radio, and we were making Jim guess them. It's a tiny bit dated in places because the election had just happened, and he was asking me what I thought of Trump as the new president. But we mostly talked about Christmas. We mostly talked about the Magi. We mostly talked about the Star of Bethlehem. So, Jim, you're honored to be on 2 weeks in a row. You'll be the first of our repeats. And then we have some other classic shows that we repeat every year. And, of course, I'll be back with you for a brand spanking new show the first Sunday of January. But we're still live at the moment, so say hello again to Jim Barrier.
We still have time.
There's still time to do a little more live stuff.
Knowing that you're doing a rerun next week with me, I really hope that I don't repeat everything that I did a year ago, because that was a long time ago.
Well, just don't talk about the stars and the wise men, and you'll be fine.
Okay, we'll try not to too much, because I don't want to be repetitious and redundant.
Well, God forbid that you or I should ever be repetitious or redundant or tangential or anything like that.
You can say that again. So, okay. What we were going to talk about, but I had so many fun things I wanted to address, and it's been great.
It's Christmas time. Be as fun as you'd like.
And so I wanted to talk a little bit about the role that prophecy plays in the Christmas story. Now, this is from our friend Josh McDowell. I know you know. I was reading Josh's books before I ever met you, and another great apologist, a standout person in that era during the Jesus movement and charismatic renewal and all of those things going on, one of my favorites. And he points out there are over 400 prophecies about the Messiah in the Old Testament. The odds of one man fulfilling just 8 of those prophecies is a number 1 in with 17 zeros, 10 to the 17th. So to illustrate this, he said, if you took that number, 10 to the 17th power, silver dollars, and placed them in the state of Texas, which, of course, the economy is better here, they would cover...
Oh, better than California? You're kidding.
Absolutely.
Really?
Gee, yeah,
who
absolutely.
Would have thought?
They would cover the entire state of Texas 2 feet deep. Now, suppose one of them is marked and thrown in the mix somewhere, and you blindfold a man and tell him to pick out one silver dollar, and he picks out the one that is marked out of the 2 feet deep covering the state of Texas silver dollars. That's the odds of just one man in history fulfilling 8 of those Old Testament prophecies.
Yeah, and
pretty
this is
profound.
And this is very important because when Jesus came and made the amazing claims he did, not just to be the Messiah of Israel, but to actually be God incarnate, which was an important part of his claim, there's other people that have come to the world before and claimed to be God incarnate, but he came in fulfillment of so many different prophecies that he matched the credentials. And
absolutely.
It went from place of birth to date of his arrival in Jerusalem, that his crucifixion and execution was predicted, his resurrection was predicted, just goes on and on.
All of those things. And he did through his whole time on earth. I have read and checked this out. Just on the day he was crucified, he fulfilled 28 Old Testament prophecies on that one day. But it began with his birth. And so I wanted to just touch base about a few of the prophecies that Jesus Christ fulfilled and how unlikely it would be for anybody to accidentally do this or to mistakenly do this. And the first handful of them are covered in the genealogies. Now, I have people, you know, when I teach the Bible and try to get people to read the Bible, often people complain and say, why are these big, long lists of names in the Bible? What does that have any relevance to my life? How is that important? Why are those things recorded? And, of course, there are many reasons, not the least of which, in Jesus' genealogy, there has to be proof that he was the son of David. And interestingly, both Joseph and Mary, when you trace their family history, they're both descendants of David. So he meets that criteria. But it's also prophesied in the Old Testament that he would be the son of the following people. And all of these people are named in Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 through 6 in the genealogy. The first one is Abraham. Now, Abraham is an interesting fellow because there was no Mosaic law. There was no organized religion of Judaism. There was just this guy out there that heard somebody tell him to start following him. He heard a God. And later on, as you know, Melchizedek, the high priest, kind of informed him, you're the servant of Most High God. Because Abram grew up in an area and in a time when it was polytheistic. In other words, they worshipped many, many gods. There were gods for everything. And Abraham got a message from Most High God, the God that's above all other gods. And so God made a covenant with him and said, the nations of the world will be blessed through your descendants. So the Messiah necessarily needed to be a descendant of Abraham. But then he goes on in the next generation, he makes the same commitment to Isaac. And you might say, well, obviously, if it's a descendant of Abraham, he would be a descendant of Isaac. But not true. Abraham had two sons. And we know how that worked out with Ishmael. We're still fighting over that one. So he made that same promise and covenant with Isaac. And then he did the same thing with Jacob. Isaac had a couple of sons. He had Jacob and Esau. They didn't get along so well. You know, there's a lot of sibling rivalry in the Old Testament. And so Jacob, though, is the one that God covenants with and says, I'm the same basic kind of promise. So he had to be a son of Abraham, a descendant of Isaac, a descendant of Jacob, and then Jacob had 12 sons. Now, and just kind of an aside here, for all of you that are really big on traditional family values, Jacob had 12 sons by 4 different women.
Two wives and 2 concubines, which were kind of like a wife, but kind of a second status wife in those days.
Yeah, you know, that might work in some religions today, but most of your fundamental
religions, like in
churches,
Utah, maybe.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to say that because I like Mitt Romney, but
Well, when Mitt Romney ran against Obama, I always said, who do you want? Somebody who thinks he's going to be God someday, or somebody who already believes he's God now? So
we'll come back after this word.
Very good. Buying a home? Selling a home? It goes without saying that you need somebody experienced and skilled, but you also need a realtor you can trust, a man who will look out for your interests as if they were his own. This is Bob Siegel, here to steer you the right direction with just 2 words, Fred Valduti. Fred works with Realty Executives All Area, a company that has sold thousands of homes locally since 1994. Putting your home up for sale or selling a home can be stressful, filled with decisions you never anticipated. So put your mind at ease and call Fred Valduti. He sold my home for me at top price. Every step along the way, I benefited from his wisdom and a very generous usage of his time. By the way, Fred Falduti received the Executive of the Year Award for 2014. What? You say that was a couple of years ago? Listen, wise guy, do you want to mark the calendar or do you want somebody to sell your home for you? Whether buying or selling, the man you want is Fred Falduti with Realty Executives All Area, 619-719-7717. That's 619-719-7717 or fredfalduti.com.
Bob Siegel's fantasy novel, The Dangerous Christmas Ornament, is now available on Kindle, Nook, and in print copy. Check out some of the wonderful customer reviews on Amazon.com. Reviews such as this one. Wow, what an incredible story. Well-written, believable characters. The story takes twists and turns that keep surprising the reader. Although it is written from the perspective of a preteen, it is most appealing to an adult. It takes one back to those feelings and longing for adventure. I can't wait for the sequel. The Dangerous Christmas Ornament, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Jim, you were talking about the genealogies right before we went to the break.
And thank you for the Christmas music. You're hitting a lot of my favorites tonight. You know, the great Christmas hymns, a lot of them were written by theologians. And so the content on some of those songs is really, really deep. And I love those songs. So thank you for that. And we left off with Jacob. His name really meant that he was an ornery guy. He was a dirty, sneaky thief guy.
Yeah,
he was
cheat.
Yeah. So, he had 12 sons by four women. We just mentioned that. And only one of those sons was promised to be the channel through which Messiah would come, and that was Judah. And so Judah is mentioned in Matthew chapter 1 as one of Jesus' ancestors. Now, Judah had some descendants, and one of those was a man named Jesse. Now, Jesse, to me, is a fascinating character. He's like so many of the Bible characters. He was a flawed man. And he had several sons, and they weren't all from the same mother. And you might remember the story when the prophet came looking for someone to anoint.
And Samuel the prophet, right.
Samuel, and he brought out six of his sons. And Samuel said, yeah, don't you have another one?
Yeah.
Kind of like they're at the...
The youngest runt of the litter he didn't bring out.
Yeah. Because for one reason, David, if you read all of the genealogies in those books, you'll find the name Nahash. David had a different mother than the other six brothers, as well as some sisters and another brother from another mother. So David was kind of an embarrassment to Jesse.
I remember when he said, God does not look at the outward appearance as people do. Right, God looks at the heart.
Exactly. So Jesse was privileged to be part of that promise, and you can find that in Isaiah, the Savior, the Messiah, the hope of the world would come through Jesse. And then likewise in Jeremiah, similar language is used, talked about a branch shooting forth, and that would be David. And so every good Old Testament student in those days knew the Messiah would be from the house of David. That's why when the wise men came, and they asked Herod, well, where is the king of the Jews to be born? And Herod didn't know. Herod didn't pay attention in Sabbath school. But he brought the religious leaders in, and they immediately said, well, Bethlehem, everybody knows that, you know.
Which makes sense, because Bethlehem was thought of as the city of David, since that's where he was also born. Yeah.
The city of David, exactly. So you have all of these things just in those genealogies those six individuals, there's prophecy fulfilled. And like I said, if you work it backwards, you can just say, well, if he was a descendant of David, then he had to be a descendant of Jesse, and he had to be a descendant of Judah and Jacob and Isaac and Abraham. But that's not the order it's given in. Each of those was prophesied individually, and so Jesus fulfilled every one of those. That's great stuff. But then, as you mentioned, we've hit it on a couple of times lightly tonight, there's also the geography, which, as we mentioned, Hadrian didn't do well in geography any more than Herod did when it came to his history and prophecy lessons. So now we have this interesting thing. We give the Christmas story, and it says Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and then it quotes Micah, and it says this was to fulfill that which was said, you know, Bethlehem, you will not be the least of these, for out of you will come a great king. And so the fact that he came from Bethlehem was a fulfillment of prophecy. But then, wait a minute, it also says, out of Egypt I will call my son. Well, the story with Joseph and Mary, and because of Herod being not such a good guy, he had to flee, and he went to Egypt, of all places, Egypt. Because, as we pointed out, there's still controversy over in that part of the world, and Egypt was always kind of a symbol of the being in captivity and the slavery and all of that. But that's where Joseph went on the instruction he was given. And then when he came out of Egypt, it fulfilled another prophecy. And then you have the prophecy that he would be a Nazarene. Another interesting thing, because you could say, okay, where's Jesus from? Well, he's from Bethlehem. No, he's from Egypt. No, he's from Nazareth. And yet all of those things were prophesied, and it's almost as though God is playing cosmic chess and moving pieces around, and every time one of these moves took place, the scripture comments, this was to fulfill what was written.
And also the Jews that lived in Jerusalem looked down upon the Jews of the north and the Nazarene Galilee area.
Can any good thing come from Nazareth?
And that went back to the civil war they had years ago when they split between the north and the south. And so it's interesting because if somebody was going to just make this stuff up, they probably would have said that the Messiah would be born in Jerusalem, the holy city, something like that. They wouldn't claim that he'd be a Nazarene. And then the idea that he's born in Bethlehem, which is close to Jerusalem, which is in southern Israel, and yet he grew up in northern Israel— you know, that's not as likely either. Usually in those days, you grew up where you were born. So, you know, when you put all the checkers together, it's an unusual life, and yet it's all prophesied, like you said.
All of it prophesied. And by the way, for people that want to nitpick, the thing of Nazareth, Nazarene, is kind of a controversial thing. But when you read those prophecies specifically in Isaiah and Jeremiah about Jesse and David, it says a branch will come forth. Well, the word Nazarene comes from the same root word as the word branch. And so it's a play on words, if you will. He will be called a Nazarene because he was the branch of David.
Well, right. And some try to claim that there was no Nazareth in those days. There's a place we identify it as now. Yeah. And yet they've actually found archaeological evidence for it. So that's even a dated concern. Well, Jim, my friend, it's always wonderful to have you. And I want to wish you a wonderful Christmas and a happy New Year. We'll have to talk right after the show and schedule you to come back sometime in January and have you on again
really
soon.
We'll be here in January. I'll be here next week with you, folks.
Well, you'll be here. We'll both be here, and yet we won't be here. It'll be like God being omnipresent. I'm watching to make sure lightning isn't striking me from the ceiling. All right.
All right.
All right, my friend.
Thanks,
we'll talk to you soon.
Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.